Welcome to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, in association with Newsarama, Word Balloon presents part two of our conversation with Jeff Loeb. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you liked them before, check them out today. They've got all-new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet, they're going to make you glad you made the switch to Mail Order Comics for all your comic book collecting needs. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic books and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. Plus, they'd like to allow the chance for collectors and comic book enthusiasts to try new titles without paying a lot. This month's specials include Marvel Civil War's Fallen Son Captain America special, written by Jeff Loeb, only 74 cents, or the debut issue of Spawn, Godslayer, also only 74 cents. For all the details, go to MailOrderComics.com. As we wrap up this conversation with Jeff Loeb, we'll touch on subjects like the Buffy Season 8 comic book series coming out from Dark Horse Comics, a series that Jeff is going to be a part of in the months ahead. We'll also get into a lengthy discussion about the current trend of major publishing-wide events that have been happening at both DC and Marvel. And we wrap things up with a detailed discussion about the series heroes and what it takes to write this new breakaway hit series. I wanted to ask about the Buffy comic quickly because I understand that you're going to be a part of it.
And I am.
And is that way down the line?
It's way down the line.
Okay.
And to talk about it is very premature.
Okay.
But what I can say is that, I adore Joss, and I would, we spent 2 years trying to get Buffy Animated off the ground and long, long into the night kind of conversations about everything you can imagine. And he was a friend of Sam's, and that sort of gives you a free pass anywhere in life. And he called and said he had this wacky idea to do season 8 in comic form. Would I write one? And I was like, yeah, tomorrow. Whatever you want. And so he's thoroughly energized doing this, which is the most bizarre thing to me in the world, because I think he's just so insanely talented. When the muse comes, you don't ask in what form you're going to present your ideas. And the fact that he chose comics in order to do it is so validating for those of us that work in the comic book business. So it's great fun.
Back to events. I'm curious, and I'm not asking you to judge Mark's specific story, but really events in general for both companies for the last couple of years. There's been a complaint coming from fans that the actual ending of a lot of these stories isn't enough closure as compared to events from, say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And, everyone understands that, with monthly stories, everything feeds into what's going to happen in 30 days, and you want people back next month. But, I just wondered if you felt the same way, or do you disagree, have a different way of articulating it?
Yeah, I really sort of disagree in the sense that, Civil War, let's go back to 10 years ago, mm-hmm. or whenever it was, when Secret Wars ended, Ben stayed on the planet. Spidey came home with the symbiote costume. I mean, those stories weren't done. She-Hulk joined the SF. What does that mean? It's a lose-lose, no matter what you do. As you're telling one of these stories, the anticipation of what the ending's going to be is so high that, of course, you're going to wind up with people who are very vocal about how they were disappointed by the ending.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it myself on Hush. People were very vocal that at the end, they were like, so Hush is Tommy? And I was... It was never a secret who Hush was. The fact that his face was covered in bandages and the fact that that Batman didn't know who it was a mystery, but it wasn't a mystery to the reader. I introduced him. There wasn't anybody else that he could be.
Right.
And yet people were sort of, were very vocal, in that world. And I think we have to sort of judge things properly. I respect the people that go on the internet, but I think I've done a little bit of research to know that, is it safe to say that in comics, Newsarama is the most popular site?
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that, absolutely.
Okay. So I look at that, and every single time Newsarama has a poll, which is, did you like the ending of Infinite Crisis? There's never more than 5,000 people who vote. Never. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, that that's actually 5,000 people, when in fact it's probably 3,000 people with people who voted multiple times. So, but let's give it the benefit of the doubt and say it's 5,000 people.
Right.
Let's even say that there's 10,000 people that go to that site every day.
I know where you're going, and I agree with you.
All I know is, yeah, if you're selling 400,000 copies of the book, and the people that aren't buying it are, I said this about Hush, which is, we sold 375,000 copies of the final issue. My mom didn't buy all those copies. Jim Lee's mom didn't buy all his copies. So there's an awful lot of people out there that got to the end of that story who didn't come over to my house and burn all my comics. So, and I find this, constantly, which is why I continually say to my friends who are bothered by what they read on the net, that you can't go there. That's not an accurate depiction of how people see your writing and how people see your story. The two ways that you can judge that is how you feel about it yourself. Did you do the best story that you thought you could? And then secondly, as crass as it is, sales makes a difference. And if you're watching, as I watched on Hush, that every month the issue sold more than the previous month, something was happening. People were engaged in that story. And when I look at Civil War, when you start talking about the fact that the first issue sold over 400,000 copies, and when you get to 6 and 7, they were selling more than 1 and 2, then they've tapped into a zeitgeist.
Sure.
They've tapped into something that you can't explain. Now, anybody can criticize anything. Personally, I read the story. I thought it was great fun. I thought everything led to a fight between Cap and Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was surprising that Cap did as well as he did, given the fact that you would think that Iron Man could have just, basically punched him. which again, I thought spoke volumes in terms of Tony's character and what Tony was willing to do. And even the moment where Tony said, go ahead, finish the job. I mean, I think between the way that McNiven drew it and the way that Mark wrote it, there's a moment there where Tony believes that it has gone too far. Now, that's not in the text. That's what I'm reading. And then at the end, Cap gave up, and the war's over. And I sort of go, seems to me it's wrapped up pretty neatly. Tony talks about what's going to happen in terms of the initiative, and that he's hoping for a brighter tomorrow. He's made the head of S.H.I.E.L.D., and that's it, kids.
See, now, as a counterpoint,
9:50, take your popcorn and go home. I mean, I don't.
But, for me, I thought that Jenkins actually wrapped up the story in Frontline, especially given the turn that happened in Civil War VII. And I don't mean to, because I guess it is the event of the moment, and it is the point that people are arguing about. And I haven't heard people make this argument. I felt that the two reporters, Ben and Sally, confronting both Cap and Iron Man, had more resonance, especially the way things ended in Civil War VII with the people stopping Cap. And it's like, let's hear it from the people why they, why they did this. And then also, even more so, when they approached Tony and, the two reporters and said, look, we know what you did. And it's funny because I asked Bendis this just a week ago about Civil War, The Confession. Would it be part of the eventual Civil War collection? And he said, probably not. And that's why I understand what you're saying. And you're right. Cap goes away. The war ends. the movie's over. It does leave you to want, you know, to get the next trade. And that's something that, as much as I agree with you on Secret War, and I'll even say it about Crisis on Infinite Earths, the original, you know, you had the new Flash, you know, while he was about to take over. Well, certainly you'd want to follow that story. But there still seemed to be a little bit more closure. You know, just the whole fact of the Golden Age Superman just kind of, you know, walking into paradise with Lois and little Lex, and, you know, that's the end of the story. And not needing follow-ups immediately, like The Confession and like Frontline.
But you see, I can go to a place which is, I have not read Frontline, and I'm satisfied.
Did I spoil Frontline for you? I'm sorry.
No. I know what was going to happen.
Okay.
But by the same token, like, I think that's great. I think that there should be other flavors and ways. And I do kind of disagree. I do, with both Secret War and Secret War was far more of a romp than Infinite Crisis was. I mean, Crisis was designed to realign the DC universe.
Yes.
And, I mean, you got to step back and say, hang on a second. They canceled Superman after that and then rebooted the whole damn thing.
That's true.
And created an entirely new story for this guy that had been around for 60 years. So I don't buy for one second that the world came to a nice, neat little button. I just think that the opportunity to be negative has never been more available. And I don't think it's just in comics. I think they can kill a movie in an afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
I think that you know, the number of people who go to a baseball game to spit on the players because they make too much money.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to watch somebody play ball.
Oh, no, Shakespeare would be, like, killed on the Internet. Absolutely. Yeah, sucks.
I mean, I like that.
No, you know, I hear you, man.
So, like, you know, wait a minute. I just sat through 2.5 hours, and in the end, both Romeo and Juliet die? I mean, come on, guys.
Worst ending ever. Yeah.
I thought they were supposed to get together in the end.
No, and that's another thing, too, and I think you're right, that there were story expectations specifically about Civil War. You know, people expected the Hulk to show up. People expected Thor, the real Thor, to show up. And when those things didn't happen, I think that magnified some disappointment.
I think that's great. You know, people expected. Who? What? Johnny from Minnesota? and Bob from Philadelphia? They got together and decided that's the way it should be. You know, I'm not trying to be flip about it. It's just, I just came from WonderCon.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat in a room with, you know, they had a spotlight on me for whatever reason. And, and you know, there was 500 seats and the thing was packed. And there was no moderator, so I had no idea what was going to happen. And what happened is what happens every time I go to a convention. I've never met a smarter, more engaged, more fun group of people who want to do nothing but talk about how much they enjoy the stories that I write. And I find that true for everybody. I just don't see it. I don't think people travel to conventions so that they can get in the face of whoever it is and say, you know, I think Civil War sucked. And I don't know whether or not it's because you have to come out from the facelessness of the Internet or whether it is because the truth is just as many people who will step in front and say, I thought it was great, when they're in an environment when they feel safe to do that. Because the one thing that you can't deny is whenever you watch one of those message threads is that if you have a series of people who say, I think Civil War is the greatest thing ever, the thread dies. Anything that goes on. Five guys who post positive, and then it just stops. It's only when the guy says, well, I think everyone acted completely out of character and Reed Richards should have his head chopped off. But you suddenly then get 15 people going, what are you talking about? You can't chop off his head. He's made out of elastic. His unstable molecules would never allow that to happen. And, you know, 45 posts later, you're going, well, look at that. Everyone's upset with the end of Civil War. I'm like, no, it's not. It looks like nine guys, you know, decided to have an argument here.
But as far as events, the two things I heard was sometimes that they feel the end is not satisfying. And the other thing is that sometimes there's event fatigue because of the way things are marketed. And it just seems like we used to have a little bit more breathing room. Like summertime was the time for events. And then we'd have the rest of the year to really kind of reflect and see what happens with events. But both companies are, you know, event to event to event.
I just think that they always were events, and that, you know, the truth is that if marketing existed in the way that it exists now, I don't know how anyone would have dealt with the coming Galactus, the creation of the Black Panther, the Silver Surfer getting his power stolen by Dr. Doom, the Inhumans introduction, the introduction of the Negative Zone, Blast Art a Living Bomb Burst, the attack of Claw. That was a year in the FF.
Very true.
That happened.
Very true.
From FF48 to FF60, there are 12 stories, each of which is an event. So, you know, I just think that's, if it's good, it will spawn another event. The Joker's Last Laugh was badly executed and was done at the behest of editorial. So people's stories were interrupted and they were not happy about it. And I remember talking to my editor saying, so let me get this straight, I have to put Joker in this story. It's my 75th issue. I mean, what are you talking about? And they were like, well, that's what has happened. We need to put a little Joker's Last Laugh across the top. I said, well, can't we just put 75th anniversary issue on it? Wouldn't that be better? And they were like, no, we got to do this. So, you know, I said, fine. Then the Joker's going to appear at the very beginning and let Doomsday out, and that's it. And they were like, okay, fine. So that's not me being difficult. That's me trying to figure out how I'm going to try to make this work.
Sure.
And at the end of the day, it wasn't a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so I personally happen to like the way that Marvel has approached these things, which is they create an event that exists within itself. And so you absolutely could continue reading Marvel Comics and not read House of M. You absolutely could have read Marvel Comics in the last year, certainly in the X-Men group, and not read Civil War. You could read The Avengers and not read Civil War. You would miss a large piece of the rest of the story. But I don't know. If it's fun, people like it. And if it's not, they don't. I don't think things should be judged based on event fatigue or any of those things. I think if you had a really cool story, marketing's going to get behind it and tell the world. Otherwise, you're going to wind up doing a really cool story that people go, well, I didn't even know that the Hulk was coming back.
I just wonder if like things like Annihilation and even some very good miniseries that Marvel had going out during Civil War might have gotten more attention.
Annihilation is a great example. This is a group of books that, for all intents and purposes, if you had done that event at DC, would have been a disaster. It just would have. You couldn't. You don't have an audience at DC that will do. I mean, if you look at those books that led up to Crisis, the one that always dragged behind was the
Rand-Thanagar
War.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought those stories were very well written and very well done, and Ivan Reis is a tremendous artist.
You bet he is.
And I completely dug what Andy Dingell was doing on Adam Strange.
Yeah, me too. That's a great series, absolutely.
But nobody read it. I mean, you know, five of us did and loved it. So the fact that a group of creators got together, not guys that you would say are the superstars, and some guys who had never written comics before, and put together this mini-maxi series. And it made a blip on the radar with characters like Quasar. I mean, come on. And I'm sure there's somebody who's reading this or listening to this that's sitting around going, hey, buddy, Quasar's like the coolest guy ever. And I'm like, yeah, okay, great. but, you know, to me, the fact that it worked at all is because there's a good story there. People came to it, and now they're going to do another one. I don't know whether or not it'll do as well or not do as well, but I don't think that that story would have gotten 5 more readers had Civil War not been going on.
Really?
There are certain things that you can do that they just have a ceiling.
Now, you picked the weakest link, but, I mean, you really don't think, like, you know, Nova, and, I mean, Nova certainly was, at its, you know, in its time, an interesting property and might have that kind of resurgence if it would have been given a clearer field to kind of just breathe and say, hey, yeah, remember Nova, kids? Well, he's back. Maybe not. maybe Nova is my Quasar.
Come on. What are you saying? That's like, to me, that's okay. Like, every time someone says to me, there's going to be a big Nightwing event, I go, okay, that's an oxymoron somewhere.
Really? Wow, okay.
I mean, like it's a cool character, but he's either, you know, Batman Light or Big Robin.
Big Robin.
I mean, that's what he is. And so, you know, it's sort of like saying to me, we're going to have a big Falcon miniseries. Okay, let's get behind that.
No disrespect meant to Sam Wilson and his fans. Okay. There's the disclaimer.
You know, I'm just saying that there are certain characters, just like there are certain television shows, that are going to hit a ceiling. There just isn't an audience that's going to come to that. And it wouldn't matter whether or not Frank Miller and Jim Lee and Todd McFarlane all came down from the mountain and said, we're going to do Nova.
Okay.
I think everyone would go, yeah, okay, it's Nova.
Right.
You know, it's like everyone's standing around going, oh, I can't believe how bad they messed up Firestorm. Like, that would have been the greatest book of all time. Really? Because, you know, it was a good book, but he's a B character.
Okay.
He had a B audience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I would have re-envisioned him the way that they re-envisioned him, but, you know, they took a chance. People are standing around, you know, with Manhunter trying to figure out why Manhunter doesn't work. Why should Manhunter work? You know, our business works best when the icons are working. If you're going to try to launch a lower tier B or C character, and I'm not saying that I'm not being critical of those characters. I'm simply saying that in terms of the impact that they've had to the readership and to the larger universe is more at a B or C level than an A character has done. And, you know, and theoretically, if you look at Wolverine's first appearances, particularly in the Hulk, you know, there's never been a greater B or C character who managed to very quickly be reinvented in a way, but largely due to the fact that he was then brought into the X-Men, and the X-Men enabled that character to grow beyond that. And even so, if you stop and you look at those characters that were reintroduced by Cockrum and Ween, you know, there's never been Colossus was never more popular than when he came back from the dead. That's his biggest story. You know, Nightcrawler has been is a great character amongst other characters. I don't think you want to hang a monthly book on Nightcrawler. They've tried. But you have a better chance of those things launching and those things working better if your top tier is working. And my feeling is that when Civil War gets people excited about Marvel Comics and gets people excited about characters like Captain America and Iron Man, which, by the way, 2 years ago, nobody cared. No one cared. You could take Iron Man and throw him out a window, and people would go, eh, they just threw Iron Man out a window.
Well, I think that was because of Warren and Adi being off schedule, honestly, because I think there was anticipation for that Iron Man book. I agree with what you're saying, though, about the icons.
But, I mean, the anticipation or not, the when you look at in the bigger picture of what Quesada's editorial campaign was, which was to first come in and fix the X-Men group and make it smaller and bring in Joss Whedon and make that more accessible. And sights on the Spider-Man books and brought in JMS and kind of refocused that in a way that's now sort of up and running. And I was at DC and I would run into him all the time and I would say to him, because I'm an Avengers guy, going, that's the one area you have just let fall to nothing. And he would just look at me and go, we're going to get there, you're going to see. And again, you want to talk about fan reaction. I don't remember anybody talking about Disassembled with any kind of love. And yet, somehow, Brian weathered that storm and launched New Avengers to the hue and cry of, oh my God, Spider-Man and Wolverine are going to be in the Avengers. We might as well just pull the plug right now. We might as well just get in our cars and drive off the Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, like, guys, you know, it's comics. Let's see what happens.
Absolutely.
And we saw what happened. The Avengers franchise is now the number one franchise at Marvel Comics. The idea that the Avengers outsells the X-Men is mind-boggling to me.
That's a fair point.
Except that I always thought that's the way it should be. And now there's an opportunity for Cap and Iron Man and Thor and those, you know, core Avengers books to get reboosted and to, you know, come along and have a kind of resurgence, which, you know, I'm sure everybody who's getting to this point right now in this interview are now going to blow their brains out. It has not happened since Heroes Reborn. And that's just a fact. I mean, you can go and you can look at all of the different permutations of those characters, but the greatest impact on those characters up until Civil War, with the exception of maybe the Ultimate Universe, which I don't know that you can count, was Heroes Reborn. And if it had worked out and the political climate were different, because that's what killed Heroes Reborn, not sales,
that's what
not
I was gonna
interest,
ask.
Not fan, not any of that. Politics killed that. Those books would have continued in the top 10, where they had not been for years. And again, I don't know whether or not anything should be judged on sales or not on sales, but I do sort of feel like it is the barometer upon which we have to see whether or not something's reaching an audience. And people ask me all the time, you know, do you feel like that you use your artists as a crutch because your stories aren't strong enough? These are obviously very kind people. And so that's why you work with Jim Lee and Mike Turner and Jessica Campbell. And,
okay.
And I look at him and go, let me ask you something. If you had a choice between writing a script for Tom Hanks or writing a script for Joe Blow, even if Joe Blow was like a really great actor and you could make a really interesting independent film, yeah, I suppose. I just tend to write stories, first of all, hopefully to the strength of the artist. And secondly, I want my stories read by the greatest number of people. And so if Jim Lee makes that happen for me, then fantastic. At the end of the day, I still have to deliver a story. And without being critical to anybody that came after Hush, Jim hasn't seen that success. So while there are people who believe that the only reason that Hush succeeded was because Jim drew it, I think you've got to step back now and take a look at what Jim did since then and go, well, maybe Loeb had something to do with it, maybe. I'm not looking for, like, you know, somebody to hand me an award and a tissue. I'm just saying, this is what I do. I just tell stories, and I tell them the best that I can. And I'm hoping that folks like it. And I'm hoping folks that are reading this interview aren't sitting there going, geez, what a pompous windbag. Because I'm not, at the end of the day. All I'm doing is just looking at what all of us try to do. And I do believe that guys that are the fans of Nightwing are great, great fans. And they believe that character is better than Batman. But the greater majority of people who read comics disagree. That doesn't mean that the people that are reading Nightwing are wrong. It just means that it's just that's the way that it is.
Sure.
And, you know, this is, like, Jeff Johns and I, because we share a studio office, would refer to this as the sleeper effect. And what that means is, and this is with no disrespect to Ed Brubaker, sleeper, let me be generous, sells 12,000 copies.
Yes.
Personally, I think it sells 8. If you go on a message board and you read about that, you would think that when Moses came down from the mountain and had talked to God, he brought back with him a copy of Sleeper. It was that good. And when you look at Infinite Crisis, or you look at Civil War, or you look at Hush, and you read the criticism, you must sit there and go, oh my God, these guys, they should have just put Ed Brubaker on those stories, and they would have been the greatest stories of all time. Well, they may have been, because I think Ed's a talented fella. But the truth is, the people that are commenting on Sleeper are buying Sleeper. That's all they're doing is buying Sleeper. Of course they're not going to knock it. If there's only selling 8,000 copies, why would you buy the book if you're not liking it? Whereas, if you get into something like Civil War and you're selling 400,000 copies, that means there's people that are picking that up that have no idea what it is. And so, of course, they're going to have opinions about it. And I watched this happen to Jeff because...
Yeah, Infinite Crisis.
He lived in a very safe world on The Flash. You know, it was a book that was selling 28,000 copies, and it went to 40,000 copies. And then it went to 50,000 copies. And everyone who wrote about him because he is the greatest guy in the world.
You bet.
And wrote about The Flash and what Jeff was doing as though he could do no wrong. Then Jeff does Infinite Crisis, where he now is exposed to an audience that's 4 times the size of that.
Right.
Which means at least a fourth of that audience, roughly the same size of his Flash audience, now has an opportunity to say, this guy can't write his way out of a bag.
Sure.
And that's what happens as you grow. And you can't let that affect you. You just need to be able to try and tell the best story and have the satisfaction and the fun that a greater number of people are reading those stories and are involved in it and feel so compelled that they're going to express their opinion in a comic book store, or they're going to express their opinion online, or they're going to express their opinion wherever they're going to do it. But I always find it very curious is that despite the fact that it's the worst experience they've ever had in their lives, they're buying the next issue.
Well, that's what I'd say about sales, because I agree with you going in, you know, a final chapter will get huge numbers, but it's the question of are they back next month that would reflect. It's like boxing. You're only as good as your last fight. But we don't know what happens until the end result, and then the question is how are you looked on for the next fight? And the same thing would go for the next issue. And I also agree that the Internet absolutely only represents a portion of the reading audience and not the majority.
Personally, I thought that Civil War was the best thing to happen to comics in a long time because it brought in so many people to read comics. And now there'll be more people. And hopefully they'll stick around.
I know that you and Tim Kring have this history going back to Teen Wolf 2. And it
Well, let's not try to go there.
Hey, Jason Bateman has redeemed himself. What are you talking about? You knew him when, and you can say, I saw
That's
it even
true.
Then. Are you done for the season, or I guess not then?
No, we shoot, I would say, probably until the 13th of April. And then we get our big hiatus because we're back May 1st.
Oh, you're back shooting next season May 1st. Wow.
Yeah. Usually you get between 6 to 10 weeks. But there's so much concern about the writer's strike.
Oh, I didn't know one was coming again. Oh, my God.
That they want to get everybody up and going. And,
sure.
I mean, the truth is, We started in May last year, but we didn't, the exception of the guys that worked on the pilot, Tim and Aaron and Joe, you know, everybody was new. So, you know, whatever break we got, I didn't get a break because I literally left Lost and started here.
Wow.
So it's just been, you know, just, we just keep running. It's all, you know, eventually we'll explode. I think that's how it works.
You started to say how you and Tim rehooked up for Heroes.
I was over at Lost, and, you know, we've stayed in touch with each other, but, you know, both of our career paths has kept us fairly busy, and it's hard to do that, particularly in this town. They're always good, and we'd see each other, you know, maybe a couple times a year kind of thing. I have a tremendous fondness for them as a couple. He and his wife are fairly amazing to see. They're, you know, they've been married forever and are still very much in love. And given the fact that I never learned that lesson, it's sort of interesting to watch. So he called and said that he had something that he wanted to talk to me about. I really could not have guessed in a billion years what he was going to spring on me. And he said that he had some ideas to do a show about people, ordinary people that had developed extraordinary abilities, and he just wanted to bounce it off of me. And so we started talking, and I realized that this was not something that he had just thought about. This was something that he was fully formed in his head, and he was going to go pitch the network, and he wanted to talk before he did that. And so we met over at the treehouse and walked. And people who don't know this area, first of all, nobody walks in L.A. There's a song about it. But secondly, we walked from Sherman Oaks into Universal City, which is, I don't know, 8 miles. I mean, all I know is that we started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we realized it was 8 o'clock. It was starting to get dark. And so if we didn't head back, we would never return. And it's not like you can call a cab, you know, in L.A. You just, all you can do is walk back. And what was extraordinary was that he knew every scene, knew almost every line of dialogue, and he certainly knew every moment. And he told me this story, and it was extraordinary to listen to. And, you know, every now and then he would ask a question, or he would have an idea. Like, I remember him saying that he wanted to have a car come right at one of characters, and the character was going to lift the car up using his magnetic power, because there was steel inside a car. He had explained that to me. And then it was going to, he was going to turn the car over. And I said, Tim, that's Magneto. And he said to me, is that a power or a person? And I said, actually, it's an interesting question. I don't think anyone has ever said, I have Magneto power. And he was like, well, I don't know. And that's when I realized that not only had he never read a comic book, or if he had, it had been 20 years, he hadn't seen any of the movies. He'd never seen an X-Men movie. He'd never seen Spider-Man. He'd never seen Superman. He'd never seen any of these movies.
Okay.
But what he knew instinctively, which is what I think is the gift to the show, is that it's the characters that make the difference, and the power is sort of irrelevant. Or if it's about the power, you deal with the power in the same kind of way that when we talk about a character, you know, our first questions are, is it a man or a woman, and how old, and is she married or not, and if she is, what's that relationship like, and then what does she or he do for a living, and you go through all the things that you would do in order to break a character, and then you start figuring out what the power would be, but the power we deal with the way that you would give a character a handicap or
sure.
whatever, you know, an impairment, I guess is it's politically correct. And so, you know, in the same kind of way that Nathan can fly, it's treated in a way that if you lived your whole life and you woke up one morning and you were blind, what would you do? How would it affect your life? And you would go through all of the plausible stages, most of which begin with denial. And that's what really made it interesting, was that other than the hero character, everyone denied what was going on. Peter wanted to know what was going on, but but didn't understand it. So he had the furthest journey. Hero had really the shortest journey because he immediately embraced what it was that he wanted, and then he just wanted a quest, and the quest came to him right at the beginning.
The female mechanic that only has the one appearance in the one episode was great. And, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, on the one hand, she thinks it's fantastic, but, yeah, you're right, dealing with it like it's a handicap and stuff, having to play that loud music to shut the world out from her super hearing.
And that's Krang. You know, and that is one of the unkept secrets of our show, which is that unlike most shows where, as Tim described it to me, you know, when you go and get your chance and you have to staff up, usually the networks give you enough money to get a, to use baseball as a metaphor, so that you've got a pitcher and a catcher and maybe a second baseman who's kind of good, and then everybody else is from the farm team, and you hope to hell that they know how to play baseball. And Tim's approach was, given the fact that shows die in two episodes, why not buy the Yankees? And he showed me the list of people that he was going after. And they were six men and women who had the ability to run their own show, and some of them had. And I looked at him and said, okay, this is either the greatest idea ever, or when you come into the writer's room, it's going to be like that scene in a Western where you go to the saloon and there's people shooting at each other and just diving off of the balcony and, you know, the chandelier comes crashing down and, you know, it's just, it's going to be the greatest disaster ever. And he was fairly confident that he could create an atmosphere where that wasn't going to happen. And, you know, the guys that are here, you know, from Jesse Alexander, who came over from Alias and Lost, and Brian Fuller, who had created Wonderfalls and Dead Like Me, to Michael Green, who had run Everwood, and Jack and Bobby, and, you know, was once upon a time on a show called Smallville. And it's just amazing that this group of people could get together. And then added into that mix were Armisen Foster, who are just these amazing writers who, you know, have worked on lots of shows and who you can give anything to, and they just do a great job. And then the two youngest guys on our show, Aaron Collide and Joe Pekaski. Aaron was on Crossing Jordan, and Joe worked for Tim at Crossing Jordan. And oddly enough, they became, in my opinion, the most important guys of the show, because they understood the show out of the gate and really got what the big stories were going to be and really what the little moments were going to be. And it really just sort of instantly felt like we hit the ground running. You know, we just became a ball club. And Tim had this other wacky idea, which is, because we were so pressed for time, you normally on a series, you normally allow the writer, you sit in a room and you break the story, and you create an outline, and then you give it to the writer, and the writer goes away for 8 or 9 days and comes back with a first draft. You give him notes, he goes back, blah, blah, blah. And that's the way I've always worked, except when you're in trouble and you're behind. In this case, you gang write the story so that you hand out sometimes scenes, and sometimes you hand out whole acts, and you put teams together, the people that have never worked together before, and that was very common on Lost.
Okay.
But Tim's idea was, let's do it from the top, because we have so many separate storylines. Maybe we could ask Jeff to write Nikki, and ask Brian to write Claire, and ask Jesse to write Nathan, and let's see where that takes us. And we wrote the first three scripts, which are episodes 2, 3, and 4, simultaneously.
Wow.
And all came back, you know, literally stayed here and sort of banged through for a few days. Because when you're only, I mean, if you think about it, some of those stories are 4 scenes.
Yes.
And none of our scenes are more than 2 pages. So you have to write 8 pages, which is a day's work.
Okay.
You know, it's not like you have to go off and write a 50-page script.
Right.
And our structures are so strong that you're not faced with, how do I make this work? You're much more faced with how do I make these scenes work, which for a writer's perspective is a much easier place to get to. And then we put them together. Now, you got to understand, this is a little bit like, you know, I'll go out and buy the eggs, and you go out and buy the flour, and you go out and buy the butter, and we're going to meet on Thursday and throw them in a bowl and hope that it makes a cake. And it worked. And it was so thrilling. Like, we all sat around going, this isn't bad. This is sort of good. And, you know, because you, when you're a writer in Hollywood, all you ever do is just expect the Hindenburg.
Sure.
You know, it's just like, you know, you have all the hopes and dreams that you're going to be able to take this big, giant, fancy blimp, and you're going to be able to go across the country, and it's going to be the greatest thing ever, and see the Atlantic Ocean, and you'll have luxury seating, and it'll be fantastic. And instead, it blows up in New Jersey. And oh, the humanity. So, you know, our little show suddenly had a new way to do business. And I don't know any show that works the way that we do. Certainly not a one-hour drama. And we kept it. And we have this ability to be able to break a story very quickly, hand out the scenes. Generally, people stay here. We work for a few days, put it back together again, and then give it to the writer of record. And then it's his or her responsibility to walk it all the way through production,
okay,
through editing, through everything. And that was the other big draw for me. You know, the piece that I left out was that, you know, 2 months later, Tim called and said, I have a pilot. Would you come over and take a look at it? And I went over to his office at Crossing Jordan. Put me in this little tiny room with this big giant television set. I literally was like 5 inches away from this screen because the room was so small. And I was devastated. I mean, like, at the end of it, I was just about crying because it was so overwhelming how emotional the stories were. And I came into his office and he was like, well, what do you think? And I said, I start Monday morning.
Cool.
And he said, what do you mean? And I said, I'm starting Monday morning. And he said, you're working on Lost. I said, I don't care. Let's work it out. I have to be part of this. And then we spent a couple of hours talking about, you know, where I could fit in and what would happen. And the real concern about our friendship and what it would be like to have somebody that's a friend working on the show. And I, you know, I took the same approach that I take to everything, which is, look, if it doesn't work, I'll quit. It's not a big deal. And it worked. And I, given the calamity that my life is, to find this show at this time, while I would have loved to have shared it with my son, because he would have gotten the biggest kick out of it.
Yeah.
It gave me a place to go. And I'm here most of the time. You know, I'm here right now at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you know, I won't go home until 9 o'clock. And there's, what's amazing about television is there's always something to do. There's a set, there's a writer's room, there's post production, there's casting, there's something to do. You just need to go to it. And the way our show works is, if what you want to do is sit in your office and write, that's great. Sit in your office and write. If what you want to do is go to the set, go to the set. If what you want to do is just hang out and post, go. Do it. Just do it with passion. And that's what Tim likes to inspire in people.
So are you still following one character, or do you guys switch off?
No. We very much switch off.
Okay.
And that's actually the challenge and the fun of the show. I began writing a lot of Nicky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you bounce around all over the place, and there's just certain guys I, you know, I really like. I'm, you know, of late I've been writing a lot of Matt, the police officer.
Okay.
Just, I like Greg's voice a lot.
He really is great. I loved him on Alias, and he's fantastic on those too.
He's the ambassador to the world, as I like to refer to. You can send him to anything, and people go, you're great. He just cracks me up.
We met in Orlando, the cheerleader and Siler.
Hayden and Zach, yeah. You know, Zach came to the show very late. If you look at the first 3 or 4 episodes, you know, people thought that we were being clever and that we were hiding his identity because it was going to be Nathan or somebody. we hadn't cast him yet.
Oh, wow.
I mean, we wanted him to be a dark, mysterious figure, and you don't want to hire an actor and have him not talk or do anything. And so, you know, we knew exactly when he was going to appear. We knew that when we did the cheerleader story that he was going to have a face at that point. And, you know, we saw a lot of people, and Zach just came in and had this sort of very quiet intensity to him. And, you know, I think in a lot of people's minds, we were going to cast somebody that was like a big, giant, you know, serial killer kind of guy. And instead, we, you know, he's fairly slight and very soft-spoken. But, man, he's scary as hell.
Oh, yeah.
But not in real life. You know, in real life, he's the sweetest guy in the world. And Hayden is just nothing short of remarkable. I mean, she's been acting since she was a baby, literally. She's turned 17 during the season.
Wow.
Playing a 16-year-old. And her level of emotion and depth is extraordinary. And when you see her cry on screen, those aren't fake tears. She can bring that out.
Wow.
And can do it take after take. And what really makes her extraordinary is when you do a shot, which is over the shoulder, so that the camera is on, like her father,
right.
Archie Bennett. And, you know, sometimes the actor, when you're shooting over the shoulder, you know, just gives a reading. It's not that big a deal. And so the actor who's facing camera is forced to try to make a performance out of something that's not necessarily the person that they're acting with is very strong, because they're saving it for their side. And Hayden doesn't do that. Hayden just gives it to you. And so she'll cry on every take, even when she's not on camera.
Wow.
And it's just incredibly helpful to the actors that they're working with. You know, in an odd way, you know, she's one of the most professional people I've ever worked with, even though she's...
I love all the people that you're bringing in, like Eric Roberts and George Takei, and, you know, Richard Roundtree is coming up, I hear, and, you know, that's great, and that's certainly, I think, any person who's a fan of this kind of genre is, like, thrilled when these people do walk on, so the casting is amazing as well. Plus the regulars, and it was, I never realized that Bennett was Stephen on Dynasty.
He was Steve Carrington. And he tells stories of those days because he was a young guy. You
sure.
Know, and he was a young, handsome guy.
Oh, he looked like Sting. I remember it well, absolutely.
And, you know, but he played gay on the show.
Yes, so, he did.
And, you know, in those days, there was only three networks. There was no cable. There was no alternatives. You either watched ABC, CBS, or NBC.
Right.
And so he would talk about how, you know, on a bad night, they would have 50 to 60 million viewers. And so, no, he couldn't go anywhere without people recognizing him, but they thought he was gay.
Sure,
so,
sure.
Like, you know, this is a young man's opportunity to conquest anything, and his opportunities are limited. Which is so, if you knew Jack, it's just so Jack's life. Except that, you know, now he has this insanely beautiful wife and insanely beautiful daughter.
That's cool.
They're just great. They're great people. I know it all sounds like, you know, isn't Jeff Loeb so full of it that it could be that much fun over there? Because particularly a first-year show, if you look at any first-year show, there's usually at the end of the year mass firing.
Sure.
And it isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's because if you stop and you think about it, particularly on your writer staff, you're trying to find the show.
Absolutely.
And when it's an original idea, it's generally in the head of the creator, and so that person, you know, finds two people that are able to sort of figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, in the second season, you have a much better sense. And if you have two people that have figured it out, they know two people. So then you start building your staff out from there. And that's what happened on Smallville. Smallville fired everybody in the first year except for one or two people.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Lost. And, you know, and so when people called us to say, you know, who are you getting rid of? We were like, probably nobody. Kind of like everybody here.
That's cool.
And that's, again, I think just speaks volumes about Crank. and what he's trying to do here. You know, I mean, we really are trying to make a better mousetrap.
Sure.
You know, when you have people that have had as much experience as the people here, you sort of have a why not attitude. What's the, you know what works. You've come from it. Why not try to see whether or not you can push the envelope out a little farther and maybe create a new model?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do that without a guy like Crank, because Tim's natural instinct is to throw people in the deep end and see whether or not they can swim. And if you can't swim, it's okay. He'll know not to throw you in the deep end. It's not as though you then get fired. He'll find where you can swim and make sure that you do well there. Whereas, you know, a lot of guys, you know, again, I've heard him say it a billion times. He's done this for so long. And when I say for so long, you know, I don't want to make it sound like he's an old guy. I mean, but he's been in television for 20 years and started young. So, but his attitude is that there's more than enough credit to go around. And when you inspire people and you don't hide the fact that you're a team show, and you don't need to be that person who's out in front, and continually remind everybody that the only reason why they have a job is because of you, or that you desperately need to be the smartest person in the room, it just creates a different atmosphere. And Tim doesn't foster that in any way. Instead, he fosters the exact opposite, which is he wants everybody else to be the smartest people in the room, which really empowers your staff. And then empowers and turns your scripts, and that empowers your crew. And you know, whether or not we knew whether or not it was going to be a hit, the one thing that I knew that was odd was that I would walk down on set. This is before we ever aired.
Okay.
And we had 7 episodes in the can when the first episode aired.
Wow.
So we'd been shooting for months. And I would walk down on set, and the people in hair and makeup, the drivers, the electricians would stop me and say, "What's the next script?" And I'd be like, "Is that because you need to know how many lights we're getting?" And they would look at me like, no, I want to know what happens. And I'd be like, "Are you kidding me? Like, we're just telling stories. It's okay. You'll get us." No, I want to know. And so I think we all experienced the same thing, which was if we could get an audience to come, then they would stay and we'd see what happened.
We're seeing now with Lost some people, and I don't, you know, again, I don't know, and I don't mean to, like, give credence to the Internet, but it just seems in general, because I know ratings are down on Lost, where some people are like, they're not giving enough clues. And when you're in a show like this that is doing something innovative and is dealing with clues, is that something you can maintain? I mean, there are white hot shows, you know, that were white hot 2 years ago, like something like Desperate Housewives, that, you know, really have kind of cooled off and everything.
Well, I think Housewives hasn't. I actually think Housewives is sort of extraordinary in the fact that their second season took a dip, and they decided to come out and say, "Yeah, we know. Come back, and we'll show you that we really know what we're doing." And
okay.
They did, and it worked, which I thought was sort of amazing. Look, we made a conscious effort. We looked at what some of the other shows were doing and decided that we would probably not let things go for more than 3 episodes before we explain what happened.
Okay.
And it's not a policy, but we try to sort of look at it and go, how do we do this and reveal those things along the way and yet keep enough balls in the air that the audience is still compelled to come back. And, you know, certain things that we could have never guessed were going to work are sort of staples of the form, and yet it works. And that's, you know, our Act 5, which, you know, is the last part of the show,
mm-hmm.
You know, became this, you know, the marketing department picked up on it and, you know, it said, "And be prepared for a hero's cliffhanger, the likes of which you've never seen." And we were like, that was like the second show. And we were like, okay, now they're called Heroes Cliffhangers? I didn't know that it was a trademark. But we embraced it and figured out you know, it didn't matter which character you were involved with, at least one of those characters was going to have an ending that when it came up to be continued, that we hoped that we had earned it.
Sure.
And I remember on one of the early shows, just as a mistake in post, we left it off. And people were like, wrote in, like, what happened to be continued? And we were like, okay, we need to put that back on the show. We didn't realize that was a character, too.
Just the title card that says to be continued.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
In the Tim Sale font. So it's just, you know, it's one of those things where you don't try to mess with success. And we've been very careful to continue to widen the story, but at the same token, tighten things up. And we're hoping that the, you know, last five episodes are very satisfying. It's always hard when you're burning as hot and white as we are to guess what do you think is going to happen.
It's the top new show, isn't it, of the season?
Yeah, it's the most popular new show.
That's crazy.
It's absolutely insane. I mean, like, you could never... I mean, somebody has to be.
Sure.
but you don't ever expect that it's going to be you, but...
Well, this could have been Misfits of Science.
It could have been.
You know.
Unfortunately, there's not enough good Misfits of Science. but, you know, Crane and all of us talked about that it could only be one of two things. Either the Hindenburg or the greatest thing ever. It was not a show that was going to land in the gray.
Yeah.
And people were either going to embrace the fact that there were ordinary people who had extraordinary abilities and we were going to tap into whatever that zeitgeist is that makes Spider-Man this giant thing. You know, I mean, if you look at the top 10 movies.
Yeah.
With the exception of Titanic, and you could make an argument that Titanic is also fantasy. They're all fantasy-driven stories.
Yep.
And there's something to that. You know, it isn't, you know, people want to poo-poo it and say, well, that's just a lot of 14-year-old boys that are going to the movies a billion times. And you want to go, no, that wouldn't work every time and through two generations.
Yep.
There's just something to it. And there's something about the ability to be able to tell stories through metaphor that is very exciting to the human spirit. Again, at its core, what Heroes says to the audience is, these are difficult times, but don't worry. One of us, and it could be you, will rise up. And it doesn't matter whether or not, and I'm trying not to get lofty about it, but it doesn't matter whether or not it's Jesus or Buddha or Gandhi or Superman. That kind of feeling that a single individual can make a difference in a time when it just sort of feels like there's a lot of things going on that are out of our control,
mm-hmm.
is a very warming experience. And you can't predict what's going to happen. I mean, I have to tell you, I saw the Kidnap pilot, and I just thought it was great. I thought it was well written. I thought the acting was really strong. I loved the New York of it all. And I really strongly, you know, considered going on that show. Because it just looked like it was going to be the next big thing. And when it didn't work, people immediately said, well, of course it didn't work. Nobody wants to see a show where a guy gets kidnapped. And I was like, okay, well, I did. But you could tell that the sort of the anxiety of it, the anxiety of the nine, which is
yes.
nine people are held hostage in a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't want to watch that. I don't want to be part of that.
Right. Why share in someone's misery? Or the after effects of how
exactly.
it's, you know,
and,
yeah.
And so it's just a very odd experience.
That's cool. You had said before that your role in Lost was to not only write, you know, individual stories, but also to kind of help break the stories and come up with, you know, scenes and it seemed like, you know, kind of fill out scripts and things like that. Is this a similar role in Heroes, or are you, you know, you've explained that you're writing one specific character, but are you
no,
in
I
the
mean,
room?
I,
or are you?
You know, I've had two episodes and, and where, you know, I've gone all the way with them, and but the I think the main thrust difference is that both on Smallville and on Lost, I was essentially what I affectionately refer to as the room monkey, meaning I stayed in the writer's room 90% of the time, which meant all of my skills as a producer, someone that would be on set, could deal with the actual physically making the show from casting to post, were being held in check. And that was one of the big driving things that got me here. Jesse Alexander, who's my partner in crime here, and I sat down at the very beginning, and I said to him, "Look, you know, I can't be the room monkey. I'm sorry. I love breaking story, and I love writing, and I'll give you 100%, but I just can't be in there all the time." And he looked at me and he said, "Dude, I hate going to set. So if you'll be the set bitch, I'll be the room monkey." And that was sort of, you know, and it's not that cut and dried, because we all swim in each other's cesspool. But we've pretty much found ways of helping each other out and working to each other's strengths. And it really is, you know, that baseball metaphor was never stronger. And the idea is that, you know, could a second baseman play third base? Absolutely. Could a guy in right field pitch? He might. But we've all sort of found our areas. And I like moving around. And I like being in all different departments at all times. It just keeps me busy.
Do you see a day where you'd be running a show and, you know, might do this down the road?
You mean something I've created?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
You know, and that was the original plan. I mean, I when I first started out, you know, that's what I was doing. I was doing pilots. And so when they asked me to go on Smallville, my agent called me and said, you know, you've only been a general. Do you know how to be a soldier? And I was like, I don't know. I mean, you're right. I've only been a general. So let's go find out. And if it's a disaster, I'll quit. It's not, you know, again, it's not, I don't live in a world that's driven by fear. I live in a world that's driven by fun. And if it's not fun, then goodbye. And that's sometimes very frustrating to people who want to drive you by fear. And I think you find that in every business. You know, I'm sure that there's guys that are working at Home Depot that are miserable because their bosses are just continually looking at them going, I'll fire you tomorrow. If what you do is you make it very clear to them, go ahead. I'll find a job on Thursday.
Sure.
They find that they don't have anything to hold over you anymore. And you can do your work. And I find that in comics as well. You know, the threat that you'll never work in this business again is my own threat. You know, the only thing that I ever am concerned about is that I'm going to hit a patch where I start telling stories and people go, man, I don't want to read your stories anymore. And it happens to everybody. You know, I mean, my heroes are, you know, Len Wein and Jerry Conway and Roy Thomas and Elliot Magan. And, you know, these are guys that eventually got to a place where they weren't the guys to go to anymore. And, you know, I'm sure they've got great stories to tell. So there'll come a time when Brian Dennis and Mark Miller, Jeff Loeb, or remember when they used to tell good stories? And I'm hoping, you know, Johns and I have a mutual suicide pact, which is when one of us starts telling a really bad story or realizes that it's gone, that the magic has left, that I go in and shoot him in the head, and then I go home. So it's not really mutual. At least we know that one of us is not going to be writing anymore.
There's our blackout. Thanks a lot, man. This has been great. And as always, you provide very interesting insights, and your perspective is always a welcome listen. So I thank you, and I know my listeners will thank you as well.
And that wraps up our conversation with Jeff Lowe. Be on the lookout for Fallen Sun and the conclusion of Onslaught Reborn from Jeff coming up through Marvel Comics. And, of course, Heroes returns to NBC television with new episodes on April 23rd. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you liked them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet, they're going to make you glad you made the switch to Mail Order Comics for all your comic book collecting needs. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic books and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. This month's specials include Marvel Civil War's Fallen Sun Captain America special, written by Jeff Loeb, only 74 cents, or the debut issue of Spawn, Godslayer, also only 74 cents. For all the details, go to mailordercomics.com. Don't forget, any questions or comments about Word Balloon, you can reach me by email, john@wordballoon.com. And if you like the show, you can subscribe to the Word Balloon podcast feed over at iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, any of the podcaster subscription sites. If you'd like to leave a review at iTunes or give us a dig at digg.com, we certainly would appreciate it. Until next time, thanks a lot for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2007.